Hello there, skeptics. I'm your host, Zoe McDaniel, and you're listening to Professional Skepticism. I'm having a bit of sensory overload right now because my computer fan is on and it's whirring. That's the sound I would describe it as, like whirr. It's whirring very loud. I'm hearing airplanes outside because I live close to the airport and I think it's going to storm. So my plan was to have started this earlier in the day, but my sleep schedule has been super fucked up. Like the other day, I slept until 5 p.m., and then I didn't sleep that night, aka two nights ago. And so I stayed up all night and then I like made plans to go out to see Aaron because he performed at the Evening Muse. He was amazing. He was the feature performer on the open mic night. And I was like, I have to go. So I got an hour and a half of sleep that day and then went to go see him. And then last night I went to bed at like midnight. This was yesterday. My days are running together. And I was like, all right, I'm on like an hour and a half of sleep. I'm definitely going to be able to sleep tonight. I'm in bed at midnight and I didn't fall asleep until like 2:30. So I woke up today at 2. It is now 4:30 and we're recording. And Ruby insists on sitting like right next to me. So I'm going to have to move her because I can hear her little bell jingling. Okay, she's gone, but she literally just bit me when I picked her up. So I'm glad she's gone because she's being spicy. Okay. I would like to give a shout out to my Patreon subscribers. If you are any form of a Patreon subscriber except for the donation tier, then you get a shout out on the podcast. So first I'd like to shout out DJ Lewis. Thank you for being my first Patreon subscriber and just overall supporter on like all of my social medias. I really appreciate you. And shout out to my dad. I really appreciate all of the support. I don't care where it comes from. And also, I want to shout out someone who's not a Patreon subscriber, but I met last night at the Evening Muse. Shout out to Eric. Thank you for being a listener. He came up to me and he was like, I love your podcast. I'm on the Appalachian Feral People episode. And I was like, oh my God, you're so early. And he was like, it's so professional. And I'm thinking like, duh, professional skepticism. But I was like, if you can believe it, it gets better, I think. Y'all can let me know what you think. But shout out to Eric. I appreciate you. I hope you enjoy your sticker. Tell the whole world about me and I will love you forever. And with that, I think that's enough business. I am so excited about this episode. It kind of came to fruition in a way I didn't expect. But today we're doing the Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos case. And I'm so excited. I mean, so I first started researching and writing notes on this topic before the podcast had even been released. I've always been obsessed with this case, like since it kind of blew up in the media. So let's get started. First, we're going to talk about Elizabeth Holmes and her personal life. So Elizabeth was born February 3rd, 1984 in Washington, D.C., which makes her an Aquarius, which kind of makes me sad because I like Aquarius typically. I like Aquarius women. I thought I liked Aquarius men and I was like going for the Aquarius men for a minute there. And like, I think what I've noticed with Aquarius men is like, I start off being like enamored with them. I'm like, ooh, you're so like different and mysterious. And then I'm like, oh no, you're just weird. But I still have big love for them. So let me just clarify that. But yeah, that threw me off a little bit that she was an Aquarius. So two of my favorite things, like I said, she was born in the 80s. So I love the 80s and she was born in DC and I love DC, even though I've only been in DC for like maybe 48 hours in my entire lifetime. But it's just so old and spooky and haunted and fun. And I want to go back. I went up there for like a concert and I was like, what the fuck? I like underestimated it. I remember I was with my ex-boyfriend and he was like, well, we were together at the time. And he was like, we should stay longer and like go see memorials and shit. And I was like, I do not give a shit. Like, I don't want to go look at like graveyards of like military people. Like, I don't know. That's just not my thing. And I didn't realize like how much DC had to offer. So we only like stayed the night, and I was like so sad about it after we got there and we're like walking around and stuff. And it was like literally 30 degrees and I was wearing like heels and tights and it was a whole thing. But okay. So this next bullet point, oh my God. Okay. This is T. We're only 2 minutes into the episode. So Elizabeth's father's name is Christian Rasmus Holmes the Fourth. And he was, I think the fourth. I'm really bad at Roman numerals. And he was the vice president at Enron. So both Elizabeth and her father are frauds, basically, is what I'm saying. Well, I don't know how much he had, like what role he played in the Enron scandals, but he still worked there. And I'm like, that can't be a coincidence. That's totally a synchronicity. And now I'm going to derail for a second, as if I haven't already been derailing. It's only 6 minutes into this recording and I'm like all over the place. So in the early 2000s, amongst other companies like Tyco and WorldCom, Enron was an energy company that experienced a serious financial scandal, and they played a huge role in paving the way for the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, which some people call it Sarbanes. I had a professor who was like very adamant that it was pronounced Sarbanes. That's like somebody's last name. So Sarbanes-Oxley Act, or the SOX Act. And the SOX Act mandates specific practices in financial record keeping and reporting. Okay, I don't know what's going on today, but I feel like my mouth feels so dry, but also like there's a lot of saliva going on. So sorry if I sound really weird. Okay, so basically, the SOX Act is a legal, what can I think? It's a law or like a legal set of rules that companies, public companies, have to comply with. So companies are required to disclose certain information in their financial statements. Chief officers, chief executive officer, chief financial officer, they basically have to sign their lives away a few times each year, claiming that they know what's going on with the company, there's not fraud occurring. If there is a fraudulent event, then they're held responsible. So if you thought that corporations got away with a lot today, can you imagine the kind of shady shit that was going down at the turn of the century? Like, what a time to be alive if you were a white businessman. So this also, we're going on another tangent. This is actually what inspired me to first become an accountant, and second, start this podcast. So SOX was basically what I spent all of my time doing when I worked as an internal auditor. I obviously am not an accountant anymore. I could be if I wanted to, but I just didn't really like the 8-to-5 lifestyle, and I wanted to do this. So here I am. But I don't think I've talked much about my work, which is actually what inspired me to start the podcast. So to my fellow accountants out there, if you were wondering if professional skepticism was a play on the accounting practice, professional skepticism, you are correct. So professional skepticism is actually a term that we use in auditing. And to exercise professional skepticism is to not always just accept everything that's given to you at face value, professionally, of course. So I'm not going to like walk up to the client and be like, fuck you, like, I don't trust you. But you know, it's like using your professional judgment to have a healthy amount of skepticism about what people are telling you, because the whole point of following SOX, being an internal auditor, is to make sure that companies are compliant with these laws, they aren't hiding any fraudulent activities, yada, yada, yada. So con artists like Bernie Madoff, Billy McFarland, episode one, Elizabeth Holmes, they all inspired me to pursue accounting, and I, it's so corny, I just couldn't get enough. So I went and started a podcast to talk about these people who think that they can get away with whatever, whenever. So I remember being in like my business 101 course and learning about Bernie Madoff. And I like knew I was going to do business of some sort, but didn't know like accounting. And I was like, dude, fuck that guy. Like, what the hell? And the way that he was found out was through, what's the word I'm looking for? Forensic accounting. So forensic accounting is really cool. It's like what they use in criminal cases. And so forensic accounting. It's investigative. That's how they basically busted Bernie Madoff. And we're going to do an episode on Bernie Madoff. But originally I wanted to do like, you know, a whole wide range of things with podcasts. So I was like, I'll do like solely white collar crime, or I'll do solely wrongful convictions, or solely this. And I just decided to put it all together. But that's honestly where the inspiration for professional skepticism came from. So we'll also do episodes on Enron, Tyco, WorldCom. Like I said, Bernie Madoff. All of this stuff is super interesting to me. But this episode is a little different because she's in the medical field. And so I feel like that just adds like an extra little oomph of fucked upness. Like, these are people's lives. So not only was she defrauding investors, but she was also putting people at risk with their health. So back to Elizabeth's life. So Elizabeth's mother's name is Noelle Ann Holmes, and she worked as a congressional committee staffer. Elizabeth came from a very, I guess, prestigious family line. Like, I think her great-grandfather was responsible for something. I don't know, like they had this big company that was like passed down. And so both sides of her family were pretty well off. So she was born into like a decent enough lifestyle. She also has a brother named Christian Holmes V, and he previously worked at Theranos as a product management director. And I wanted to just go ahead and right off the bat say that I got a lot of my information from, yes, so I got a lot of this information from The Inventor, which is an HBO documentary about this whole situation. Also, I got some information from Bad Blood, which is a book written by John Carreyrou, who was the investigative journalist who kind of brought a lot of this to light. And then The Wall Street Journal, and John Carreyrou writes for The Wall Street Journal. So I got a lot of information from The Wall Street Journal, NBC, and I'll always put my notes or my sources in my notes as I do. So moving on, Elizabeth tells this story of always knowing what she wanted to do, wanted to create, and of being like 7 years old. She has this detailed drawing and steps of how to create a time machine. Like, this is like a story she loves to tell. And I'm like, girl, you're not special. Like, I literally had time machine instructions as well pasted into the back of my closet. Okay, we've talked about this on the podcast before. I needed a wormhole and like a Toyota RAV4 and my chemistry set, and I was good to go. Like, baby girl, you're not unique. But her family also kind of feeds into this. They claim that as a child, Elizabeth said she wanted to grow up to be a billionaire, and that she didn't want to be the president because she wanted to be a billionaire and the president would marry her because of that. Her family also kind of feeds into this idea. So as we'll get into this, if you know anything about Elizabeth Holmes, you know that she's got like a lot of weird vibes going on. She was obsessed with Steve Jobs, so she would always wear like all black, like the black turtleneck. And she talked in this very deep voice like this. Hi, I'm Elizabeth Holmes. And there's like some footage of her where she's talking in a normal voice. And so everybody thinks that it's kind of this facade that she was putting on, like as a part of her persona, which I mean, that's fine. Like, that's honestly fine. Like, I know people that they sing in like a specific voice because that's what their character sings as, or like they like perform a certain way. And so, like, you know what? She's living her life. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. But it is a little bit weird just as we get to the way things played out. It's weird to me. But so her family's like, oh yeah, she always had this kind of deep baritone voice and she always dressed like that. So I don't know. But some people in her life seem to disagree. We're only like 15 minutes into this recording and I have like 14 more pages of notes. Okay, let me speed it up. So Elizabeth claims that she was always very studious. She never watched TV. Her best friends were books, all that corny shit. But I'll believe that because she was very smart. Her family was prestigious, like I said. So she had this kind of, I guess, shoes to fill as a successful person. So Elizabeth went to high school in Houston where she had a passion for computer programming and started her first business selling C++ compliant to Chinese universities. I don't know if that's a typo in my notes, or if that's even if you say C++, who knows? Computer programmers, you can let me know. And this is when she actually began learning Mandarin. I believe her father worked in China for a little bit, and so he started paying for a tutor to teach her and her brother Mandarin. And this actually allowed her to attend Stanford's summer programs to continue learning the language. It was like an immersive Mandarin program. And she did this while she was still in high school. And it was actually only a program for college students, but her knowledge of Mandarin at this level and just she was good at charming people, they let her in. And I was reading in the Bad Blood book that she actually experienced a lot of bullying while she was in these programs because they're like, you're a high school nerd, haha. So she continued learning this language, probably extremely helpful and beneficial to know Mandarin. And after going to these immersive programs, she did apply to Stanford just, you know, when she graduated for her own college experience, and she was accepted. And she went to Stanford in 2002, and she studied chemical engineering while she was there. While attending Stanford, she worked in a lab at the Genome Institute of Singapore and tested for SARS, or Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome, which I believe is like a part of the official name of COVID, so gross. But so, like I said, Elizabeth was trained as a chemical engineer, but she eventually becomes an entrepreneur, and let's get a little bit more into that. I also have a bullet point next where I was talking about she wears the black all the time, like I said. She owned a very large number of like the exact same clothes, and she would put it on. This is what she said. So she said that she would put it on so that she doesn't have to think about what she's going to wear. Like that just eliminates that whole part of your morning. You just get up, you put on the same black turtleneck, black pants every day, and you save time. To me, I love getting dressed. I love different clothes. So it's like a creative experience for me, but I do get that because sometimes I spend a little bit too long getting ready, but I've kind of got it down to a rhythm, I would say. But like I said, she's inspired by Steve Jobs and she claims to have been wearing black turtlenecks since she was 7. In 2003, Elizabeth filed her first patent for a wearable drug delivery patch. And in 2004, she dropped out of Stanford to start her infamous company, Theranos. She started this in Palo Alto, California, when she was just 19 years old. So let's talk about Theranos. Theranos is a combination of the words therapy and diagnosis. The inspiration for Theranos was her uncle. So she tells this story all the time in basically like every interview she talks about this. So Elizabeth's backstory and inspiration for Theranos blood testing was inspired by the sad demise of her uncle. So growing up, she spent summers with her uncle at the beach. They would like pile in, all the cousins and family would be there. He was the best uncle. He ends up being diagnosed with skin cancer. And then she talks about it and she says it started as skin cancer and then eventually grew to like brain and bone cancer. Like it spread to everywhere. So I think that's what she said. I could be wrong, but it was some form of cancer. So she says that he didn't live to see his own son grow up, and she didn't get to say goodbye to him, and she loved him very much. So her mission of making blood work simple, which I didn't even explain what Theranos is. If you don't know what Theranos is, I'm sorry. Theranos is like a company where she was trying to basically like streamline and make more efficient the way that we do blood work. So instead of having to have like 3 vials of blood taken when you go for your physical, they can just prick your finger, take a little bit of blood, and do like 1,000 tests on it, basically. That was an exaggeration, not 1,000, but yeah. So she just wanted to make blood work better. So her mission of making blood work simple and effective and quick was inspired by the loss of her uncle. The idea is that if we can do simple blood work and find out about illness and disease before it's too late, then we can save lives, which like, yeah. I heard that last part in like her deep nasally voice. We can save lives. So according to Holmes, the only thing in her life she has ever been scared of is giving blood, which, fair. When I was a child, I used to hate giving blood. I had this disease in first grade. I don't even remember what it was called, but I had a disease where I had to have blood taken like basically every day, and that was like the bane of my existence. Now I'm kind of good at it. I also have to give myself a shot now every month, and the first time didn't go too well, but the second time I did it right. So lab testing hasn't changed since the 1950s, and we have to take these large amounts of blood in order to use the technology that we have to run the tests. The machine created by Theranos that was supposed to do the actual blood testing was called the Edison, And Thomas Edison was her inspiration. So that's why she named it after him. You know, fail 100 times, 1,000 times, whatever, blah, blah, blah. Keep trying. So Thomas Edison had like 2,000 patents, but he often promised more than he could deliver. And this is a very strange parallel. But so he told everyone that he was going to invent light bulbs that never went out. But when he was not able to execute this idea, he ended up just giving people stock in his company to get them to stop asking questions because he couldn't figure out how to make it work. So this is a theme that we're going to see later on. The lab industry is dominated by Quest and LabCorp, which are LabCorp? Okay, I'm going to have a moment here, but I never know if it's Core or Corp. Is it always Core or is it sometimes Corp? Let me know. So Quest and LabCorp, and like supposedly they're very inefficient. They're also expensive, which fuck yeah, they are, because I've had a lot of testing done this year and it's so expensive. Like I had a full panel for STIs, STDs. Get checked, guys. It all came back negative. I'm great. I'm doing great. I'm healthy. But that shit was $630 after my insurance. And like, mind you, you can't just go and get like a full panel workup. It wasn't preventative screening, but testing is expensive, you guys. So like, this would have been such a great thing if she could have just actually pulled through and did it. But yeah, so apparently Quest and LabCorp have overcharged Medicaid and Medicare. I got that from the HBO documentary. I'm not really sure what that means or how they do it. I guess just because they're like the only two lab testing, they can just charge what they want. But this is a lesson for everybody. If you ever go to the hospital and you get a crazy bill, ask them for an itemized bill so you can see how much it adds up to, because sometimes they'll just put shit on there that they didn't even give you. And so just make sure you're looking at that because you can always rebut those expensive bills. Okay, so like I said, Quest and LabCorp have made it very difficult to challenge them in the lab market. I'm good, guys, I promise. And that's why the Edison was so innovative and exciting. It was a challenge. It was a market disruptor, blah, blah, blah. So by the end of 2004, Elizabeth has raised $6 million. And by the end of 2010, she has raised $92 million. So girl was out here getting it. At one point, Elizabeth raised more than $400 million. And the company was valued at $9 billion. I think the highest it was valued was like $10 billion at some point. So Elizabeth moves Theranos to Silicon Valley's Stanford Research Park in the fall of 2014. So like, she's been doing this for like 10 years at this point. It's like, girl, what is taking you so long? And at this point, Forbes has named Holmes the youngest and wealthiest self-made female billionaire in America. The next year, she was named by Fortune as one of the world's 19 most disappointing leaders. Why is she a self-made billionaire and she hasn't even done anything yet? Like at this point, 2014, 2015, like, I mean, it does, I think it started to come out in 2015, but it's like, how are you making profit when you haven't even like done anything yet? Like, why are you a billionaire? You're not a billionaire. Your company has money that you've raised. I don't understand why everybody was like blowing smoke up her ass, but they were. So in 2014, when she moved to Silicon Valley, she had roughly 800 employees. They were valued at nearly $10 billion. And 4 years later, it was worth less than zero. So now I want to introduce you guys to Sunny Balwani. I believe his real name is Rajesh. And he was the president and chief operating officer at Theranos. So Sunny and Elizabeth met the summer before she went to Stanford. So they met while she was still, I guess, had just graduated from high school, but she was in the Mandarin program. And so they've known each other for a while before he starts working at Theranos. They met in Beijing while she was attending the Mandarin program. So that was the next bullet point. I guess I could have just read that. So according to John Carreyrou, this is a quote, by the time he joined Theranos in September of 2009, Sunny's legal record contained at least one red flag. To dodge taxes on his Commerce Bid earnings, which Commerce Bid was a very successful company in the late 90s. It was a tech company, CommerceBid.com, and it ended up selling for a lot of money, and he worked there. So to dodge taxes on his Commerce Bid earnings, he'd hired the accounting firm BDO, which arranged for him to invest in a tax shelter. The maneuver generated an artificial tax loss of $41 million that offset his commerce bid gains, all but eliminating his tax liability. When the Internal Revenue Service cracked down on the practice in 2004, Sonny was forced to pay the millions of dollars in back taxes he owed in a settlement with the agency. He turned around and sued BDO, claiming that he had been unsophisticated in tax matters and that the firm had knowingly misled him. The suit was settled on undisclosed terms in 2008. And so I will believe that. I mean, he's like a tech guy. Maybe he didn't understand the tax liability issues with that. That's another reason I like accounting a lot, is like you can kind of just manipulate your money in a way that set yourself up for credits and like ways that you don't have to pay certain things. You put them in certain types of accounts. So I think all that is really cool. It's a great way to manage your money. It's just when people start taking a little bit too far, start acting a little bit fraudulent. So yeah. So like I said, I need to stop saying that. I'm like I said, are y'all listening, bitches? Because, okay, his expertise is software and IT. He was 49 and she was 30, I believe, when he started working there, around that age. But anyways, it doesn't matter their exact ages. They have a 19-year age difference, which there's nothing wrong with that. I once dated a man 20 years my senior, so I cannot really shame in that situation. But I mean, there's definitely a power dynamic there. There's a power exchange. No matter what you say, like there, I think there's always going to be that when there's that big of an age difference. And like some people want that and that's fine. But it is important to think about. So 19-year age difference. According to people close to the situation, they say that she was actually the dominant one and that he spoke of her like she was a genius, which isn't news. As we get through this episode, you'll see everyone like thinks that she's fucking Jesus Christ, like walking on earth. Later on, Elizabeth claimed that Sonny was the one dominating her, and we'll get more into that as well. So she lived with him in a condo in Palo Alto. So they were shacking it up. People thought that there was more to the relationship than professional, because for a while that was all it was like just professional. I guess he was supposed to be like a mentor and she's like the little protege that's like coming up with all the cool stuff. People are like, they seem a little romantic. And eventually it does come out that it was romantic. So Sonny and Elizabeth just did not care about reality. Like together they were, it's almost a little bit of like folie à deux. Like what's the phrase for that? It's like when two people are, there's a phrase, hold on. Folie à deux, the madness of two. That's what it is. So it's like when two people, maybe one of them is like experiencing some form of psychosis, or maybe they're mentally ill and the other, they're so close, the other person starts to exhibit the same behavior. I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm not saying that's what's actually happening, but it's kind of that vibe is what I'm getting from this. They specifically hired young, fresh, new tech professionals straight out of like all the really good schools, and they would push them and be like, you need to make this, you need to do this, you need to do this. And these professionals, they're young, they want to get their name out there, they want to be desirable, and so they just like wouldn't know to say no. And we'll see how like some of the older engineers that work for them are not afraid to say no. Let's talk about the investors and other people involved with Theranos that had a lot of notoriety to bring to the table. So as we mentioned earlier, Theranos was incorporated in 2004, and there was a quote said about them that they were a private company, so they didn't have to talk about what they were doing until they were done, which is how it works. So there's public and private. If you're selling stock in your company, you're public. If you don't really want that, you don't want to have to submit a bunch of stuff to the SEC, you can be a private company. So she convinced investors to provide hundreds of millions of dollars without ever looking at audited financial statements, which is insane. Most investors would like to see audited financial statements. They don't have to be like exactly to GAAP standards, which is generally acceptable accounting practices standards, which is what the SEC requires. They just need to be audited by like a reputable accounting firm. Typically, early investors will rely on their gut feelings. That's the name of the venture capitalist game, baby. So remember, Elizabeth has no business background at all. She has like a year of chemical engineering training, and that's it. No business background. I mean, I guess her family has business background. So people are like trusting in that. And also her grandfather was a business entrepreneur. There's a hospital where she lived that was named after her great uncle. Like her dad was, I guess, successful too. So this gave her street cred. She basically gave no form of data or information at all. All of it was based on her emotional connections to people. Like, people trusted her. She was like, listen, I'm selling you a dream. Can you imagine how this is going to change people's lives? Because the idea was that these machines, the Edisons, would be everywhere. They'd be in hospitals, doctor's offices, pharmacies, people's homes if they were chronically ill. She wanted them in their homes so they could take these quick little blood samples and make sure everything was looking good. She wanted to revolutionize blood work and change people's lives and catch problems before it got bad. Like, who doesn't want that? Everyone wants that. So some of her investors include Apple's former head of software, Avi Tavanian, Oracle's founder, Larry Ellison, founding investor of Oracle, Don Lucas, owner of the New England Patriots, did I not put his name? Rupert Murdoch, the Walton family, Betsy DeVoe, Tim Draper, who was a family friend, investor, and venture capitalist. So he knew Elizabeth her whole life. He was the first investor in Tesla, Skype, and Hotmail. He always invested early, and he trusted her. He believed in her. All of these men are literally obsessed with her. Like, the way they talk about her is really bizarre. Some other people, I think a lot of these people are, like, on her her board of directors or, like, worked for her. Henry Mosley, he was a former Intel employee. He worked at four other pioneering technological companies and took two of them public before coming to Theranos, according to John Carreyrou. And this little next snippet is from him as well. Elizabeth asked Henry Mosley to prepare the financial projections to show to investors. He prepared the numbers, she didn't like them, and she asked him to prepare new numbers. He had an off feeling about this, but decided to do it anyway, inflating the numbers and telling himself that it was okay because it was pretty standard within the venture capitalist world for tech startups to inflate their projections. So this practice is called hockey stick forecasting. He also figured that if everything was executed with Theranos as expected, then the numbers wouldn't be too far off, if far off at all. And so he and I can both learn from this moment, trust your intuition. I kind of hate that that's just expected within the venture capitalist community. Like, people just like inflate their projections and they're like, yeah, we're going to be so great. Just be honest. That's why I did not like finance when I worked in finance. I like accounting because for the most part, it's very straight and narrow, black and white. This is how it's supposed to be. But finance, people just pull numbers out of their fucking asses. And y'all can fight me on this one. I will die on this hill. Finance is literally just a bunch of bros sitting around making shit up. Okay, moving on. So General Mattis, former CENTCOM commander, was a board member of Elizabeth's. Dick Kovacevic was a former CEO of Wells Fargo. Sam Nunn worked on nuclear threats and bio threats. Why do I have BM? Oh, board member. Bill Perry was the former Secretary of Defense. Henry Kissinger, former Secretary of State. Henry Kissinger claimed that Elizabeth has an ethereal quality as if she was a part of a monastic order. Offensive. George Shultz was the Secretary of State and Labor and Treasury, and he really believed in her. He really believed in her. I mean, like, she was becoming a part of their family. He would invite her over for family dinners. She would come to birthdays and holidays. And this is when George Shultz's grandson, Tyler Shultz, met Elizabeth, was at a family dinner, and he was in school to be a research engineer, and he ended up working for Theranos because he met her at the family dinner, and he was like, holy shit, like, this is insane what you're doing. I guess Elizabeth and his grandfather were talking about Theranos, and he was like, that's so awesome. I want to be a part of that. And so he asked if he could intern, and she was like, yeah, sure, come intern for me. I bet she was regretting that decision, as we'll see. These people are literally going to bat for her. They're giving her the highest praises. And while her board of directors list was insanely impressive and powerful, none of them were qualified to understand the technology or medicine that she was claiming to be working on. She wasn't either. She was not either. She was just a crazy lady running this company. She also weirdly kept saying that she was doing work for the military off the record, but she would never give details. Like, why are you talking about it? Like, why bring it up if you can't talk about it? And then it comes out later, there's never any, like, evidence that this was the case. So it's like, I think probably because she just had all these, like, former, like, government people, like, maybe she thought that would look good. I don't know. This is a quote from the HBO documentary. So in a mock-up of marketing materials, Theranos invented a quote from General Mattis about a battle plan to use Edisons on wounded soldiers in combat zones. But this never happened. Before permitting Theranos to use the machines on soldiers, Pentagon officials wanted to run their own tests, but Elizabeth declined. So it's like, I guess she was having conversations with the government, but nothing happened. Okay, so now that I've laid out like how odd Elizabeth and Sonny are, let's talk about the actual machine, the Edison. They weren't inventing something entirely new because we already have lab machines that can test for these diseases. They just were automating a process that's already happening, streamlining it, making it more efficient and easier, more accessible. The nanotainer, if you've ever seen a photo of Elizabeth, it's like this little tiny, it's almost like a Tic Tac or like a little pill capsule. And that is the nanotainer, and that's how much blood they were going to take from you to be able to do the lab testing. So basically just like a little like gel capsule, not gel, but like those little pills that you can open up and it splits in two. It was like that size. And there's like, if you look her up, there's like pictures of her holding it and looking at it. So that was the amount of blood that they were going to say was needed for the testing. And that would have been amazing and beautiful. And I really wish that could have been. The idea behind the Edison is that there's like a pipette that pokes holes in the little plastic containers with reagents in them, and then they mix the reagents with some of the blood collected in the tiny nanotainer. And they were originally developing about 60 different tests for the Edison to be able to do. Later on, I think we'll say there's around 200 that they claim to do, which was never actually true. Like, they couldn't actually do all those tests. Those are just tests they were like faking it till they make it. They were manifesting that they would be able to do those tests. Theranos employees claimed that it was incredibly complicated, the process within the Edison, but they felt like they were on the path to get it right. They were like, this is really hard. We're putting in a lot of work, but like they really felt like they would have been able to make it work if Elizabeth hadn't been so adamant about pushing forward and bringing it to market before it was ready and lying to people. Like, if they had been doing it in the right environment with the right leader, maybe we would have had the Edison today and our blood work would be a lot more simple. So apparently, Elizabeth had a policy of tightly monitoring demonstrations of the Edison and access to the Edison. She would let people see it, but not talk about it. The Edison was tucked away in a downstairs lab where they had it hidden. And this is a quote, Elizabeth treats what happens in the machines as a state secret, and her descriptions were comically vague. Employees claim that prototypes would get really messy inside the machine, like it wasn't working right. Blood would spill on the machine's internals, it would get all gunky and gross, like dried blood gets like that jelly consistency after not very long after having been exposed, so I can just imagine it, and then it probably stinks. The machine would freeze up and they'd have to reach in there with their hands and fix it while there's like needles everywhere. The reagents and the blood are just spilled in the bottom of the vessel, just evaporating into the room. People are breathing in whatever's in this blood. Pieces of the device would just fall off. Centrifuges would blow up. According to John Carreyrou, the Edison eventually could correctly extract the blood and dump it into the little wells that would test the blood, but the Edison didn't always provide a result. And I think this goes back to, like, there's just not enough blood to mix with the reagent to give a result. Like, I think that was the main issue. I mean, there's a lot of issues going on here, but I think that was one of the issues. So it was like they got it to actually, like, deliver the blood to the reagents, but it wouldn't provide a result. It was like a hit or a miss. Like, sometimes it could, sometimes it wouldn't. And so they recorded from one of the times that it worked. Like, they took a little video. And that was what was displayed at the end of the demos they would do for investors. Also, sometimes during demos, they would have a room with an Edison in it. They would do a finger prick of like one of the executives that worked for Theranos blood, and they would put the blood in the Edison, And then they would walk all the execs and the investors out of the room for a tour of the facility or maybe for a lunch. And then someone would go in, take the blood from the machine, do the blood tests in the lab, and then put it back in the machine so that when investors and executives came back in, there was a result waiting for them. So here's that bullet point about the tests. It says, after some time, they advertised that they could do over 200 tests when not even half of them were validated to have worked. And again, even if they worked like one time, they weren't working consistently. So engineers working on the Edison stated that in order for it to work properly, you would need too much hardware in the machine. And it was impractical at the size that they had the Edison. I mean, I'm like, the Edison kind of just looks like a big printer. And Elizabeth didn't want the box to be any bigger. She was like, no. Like, I feel like if you have engineers that are telling you something physically will not work, why do you have these high up, really talented, amazingly smart engineers if you're not going to listen to them? Like, this is something that we see in a lot of cases. This is what we saw with Billy McFarland when he hired on all those people that had worked on festivals like for a living. And they're like, you can't do this, but you could do this. And they just don't want to listen. Like, they just want to keep going, keep going, keep going. But I feel like personally, as a consumer in America, I would much rather like be updated about, oh, you know, we're going to try this instead because the other thing didn't work. It's going to take a little bit longer, but we're going to get the product to you and it's going to work great. I would rather that than like some shoddy product that doesn't work right. But yeah, so they're like, it's too small. If we could make it bigger, we can get all the hardware in there that needs to be in there to do this correctly. And then like, it'll work. It'll just be bigger than what you thought it would be. But I think that was the whole point, that she was selling this like micro lab, the mini lab, whatever. Some of the original donors for testing the machine were just people off the street that needed money, which is typically the case when it comes to like medical surveys, medical testing. Like, it's people that, I mean, not everybody like needs money or is like off the street, but a lot of the times that's the people that go in there. Like the plasma centers where you can go donate your plasma and get like $125. Like, people go in there because they need that money. And so they were taking people off the streets of California. They were going in, testing these people's blood. And it was known that there was a fair amount of hepatitis amongst the group of people that was coming in. And so for the machine to not be working correctly, for blood to be spilling in the machine while they're like doing early stage testing, this is a huge biohazard, a huge biohazard. I mean, everything about this as we go forward. So that's kind of the status of the Edison. I want to talk to you about like employees, colleagues, people that knew her, kind of their perspective on Elizabeth. So initially, when people met Elizabeth, they were like, wow, she's very inspiring. She's a good idol for young tech enthusiasts, which pisses me the fuck off because she's not like a tech professional. I think like as an entrepreneur, yes, inspiring, great. But I wouldn't call her like a tech anything. Because she's not. I mean, she's got the chemical engineering degree, but like, or she doesn't even have the degree, excuse me. I mean, you don't have to have a degree to be good at technology, whatever, but like, obviously, I don't think computer programming, Mandarin, and chemical engineering means that you should know how to do lab work on people's blood, which is, I don't know. I'm also not educated in that realm either, so maybe I'm wrong, but like, it just doesn't make sense. So one of her professors, actually, I don't even think it was her professor, Dr. Phyllis Gardner, was a medical doctor professor of medicine at Stanford University. And she's tenured. She started working at Stanford since 1984. And Elizabeth went to Gardner, described her idea, and she was like, I don't think so. Elizabeth's, I guess, original idea, or one of her ideas, she's got a couple, I think, like I said, she has a patent, like she's got a couple different ideas. She was really good at coming up with ideas, but she needed the people to like make it execute for her. But she went to Dr. Gardner and she's like talking about this idea of a patch that you put onto your skin that would like test your blood, detect infections, and deliver antibiotics. So microfluidics in this patch, nanotechnology, nanotainer. So she wanted to put this all in a patch. It would be like, I guess, kind of like, I don't know exactly how insulin patches work and stuff like that, but I'm assuming it's like that same idea where like you put a patch on your body. I guess there would be like a tiny needle in there that would prick you and like see if anything's wrong. And if anything's wrong, it would like distribute medication to you. Anyways, Dr. Gardner is like, this is physically impossible. There's a reason that we have IV bags. There's a reason why these are separate processes. Like, you can't put all of that into one patch. Also, that sounds really expensive. And she claimed that she felt like she couldn't help Elizabeth because she just wasn't listening. She's like, listen, this is physically impossible. This cannot happen. And Elizabeth is like, no, I disagree. Channing Robinson was the head of the science department at Stanford. He left his job at Stanford to go work for her. So she was not able to woo Dr. Gardner, but was able to woo Channing Robinson. One of her employees related working to Elizabeth as drinking Elizabeth's Kool-Aid. So that says a lot. Also, we're going to do an episode on Jim Jones. But it sounds about right. I mean, there's obviously, we'll get into it, there's some employees that are seeing straight through her bullshit. But I think a lot of these old men are drinking her Kool-Aid. Multiple employees claim that she never blinked. And if you watch any footage of her, that's pretty accurate. And also another thing that was very different from other interviews that were occurring in Silicon Valley and the Bay Area is that Elizabeth met every single person who was hired at Theranos. They had these like incredibly vague interviews and she had to meet everybody. She was like, I need to be in the room, which is not common. So the employees went with it thinking like, okay, the information that they're working on is secret. Like these are trade secrets. So like, okay, like this is a big deal. They're not thinking anything of it. And the company is a startup. So maybe they just don't want to just tell interviewees exactly what's going on, which like is fair. But I think with a lot of these young, new tech professionals, they're like, you know, I haven't been in the industry, so maybe this is how it's supposed to be. So as I mentioned, we talked about how there's like the new tech professionals. There's also some older ones that are like, this is physically not possible. We need a bigger box. A common response from Theranos executives, if employees told them that something wasn't possible, was, well, maybe you're not a Silicon Valley person. Go work somewhere else if you don't believe in the vision of the product. So they're literally gaslighting these employees, being like, oh, it's not possible. It's not possible. Go work somewhere else. When like it's literally not possible. So Ian Gibbons, his story is very sad. He worked for Theranos and he was the first experienced scientist hired at Theranos. He had a Cambridge PhD and he knew things that the rest of the people that worked there didn't know because he had a Cambridge PhD. Like he knows what the fuck he's talking about. So in 2012, he's like in there being like, this isn't going to work. We need to do it this way. We need to do it this way. And they were like, you know what? You don't need an office anymore. You're no longer involved with decision making. He got in bad with Sonny and Elizabeth because he kept telling them what they wanted wasn't going to work, which was the whole reason that he was there in the first place, but they wouldn't listen. So they hired him on. They're like, we need you, like basically like consulting, like tell us what's going on. How can we do this? How can we do that? He's doing his job. They're not listening. So in 2013, Theranos tried preventing Ian from testifying against Elizabeth in a patent misappropriation lawsuit because if he testified that she was not the inventor, she claimed to be it could affect her other patents. So I guess I think this goes back to like she has these patents, but like she's not inventing these things. She doesn't know how to invent these things. So I think people in her facilities are inventing these things and she's saying like, oh, because you work for me, like I'm going to own the patent. And so I think that's where that's coming from. So he fell into a deep alcoholic depression. He's being gaslit at work. He's being threatened, silenced. He was very upset. They told him to stay home. So Ian asks his wife if she thought that he was going to be fired because he's like going through it. He's like, why are they telling me to go home? His wife said yes. And then he unfortunately completed suicide. What they said in the documentary was like he didn't know what he was going to do with the rest of his life. Like if he wasn't going to be working on the Edison, working at Theranos, like he, I guess, couldn't see past that. He's in an environment where he's being put down and he can feel the tension. They're telling him not to come in. So yeah, basically his wife says that he killed himself over working on the Edison. Like he really put his all into it and it just, he felt like I mean, I can't even imagine, like, you are trained, you have a PhD, you know what you're talking about, and these people are making you feel like you don't know what you're talking about. It was really sad. I recommend watching the documentary. Also, I believe there's a portion about it in Bad Blood, the book. So if you're more interested in learning about Ian's story, I would definitely recommend reading more about it. But basically, he was gaslit. His wife says that Elizabeth never spoke to her except to ask her to return the confidential Theranos information that Ian had stored at his home. So moving on from that very sad experience, that just shows you the pressure that these employees were under. These incredibly smart people were put in these very intense situations. And obviously, it had an effect on their mental health. Sunny also would spew to the employees that they've been attacked by Quest, who builds their company on getting people sick and needing to rely on testing. So the purpose of Theranos was to combat this. So he's like trying to convince his employees that Quest and LabCorp are the bad guys, which, like, and maybe they are. Like, I feel like the medical industry in America is fucked up, so maybe. But like this kind of mentality of like us versus them. So like we have to do this right so that we can take down Quest. Elizabeth had a ton of security at the Theranos office. She had bulletproof glass, and you couldn't just walk up to her office, which, like, I think some of the employees were like, this is crazy, but I, in this world today, I don't really blame her. Like, if you can have all that stuff, why not? Like, people get shot at the grocery store. Children get shot at school. Like, it's not out of the realm of normal, I think, at this point for her to have all of this. But so if security heard over their, like, walkie-talkies, Eagle 1 and Eagle 2 are on their way, they better be ready to pull the doors open for Elizabeth and Sunny to walk through. It did get a little intense, so Sunny tracked all key card entrances and exits. The employees would send emails amongst each other. They would not CC Sunny or Elizabeth, but they would still get responses from Sunny. So the emails were being monitored. They were looking at all of these emails all of the time. The receptionist was being keystroked. And so she talked about this in the documentary. And they asked her, they were like, is that normal for a receptionist to be keystroked? Like, at other places you've worked at? And she was like, absolutely not. Like, she's a receptionist. Theranos had a lot of contracts for their employees to sign, stating that they couldn't bad name the company, tell their families what they worked on, et cetera, which I think some of that to an extent is normal, but the way that they were talking about it, it makes it seem like it's a little bit more extreme. Like, I understand keeping certain things confidential. Like, I've met people that are like, oh, I work at a nuclear plant, but I can't tell you what I do at all. And I'm like, okay. So, like, I think to an extent that might be normal, but it seems like based on maybe what the way the employees were talking about it, it might have been a little bit intense, over the top. Maybe the wording was weird. This environment is not good. Like, everyone's being monitored. Everyone's being watched. It's very intense. Obviously, with Ian's sad, tragic death and people coming and going, it's a very intense environment. Lots of pressure. Employees are becoming paranoid of one another. There was a ton of secrecy, and it was really difficult to share information between groups in the company. So they weren't even, like, really able to collaborate and talk to each other to make the dream work. Like, that's what you gotta do. You're all there for the same purpose, but they were making this weird environment where, like, that wasn't really feasible. So to the public, to the investors, they all think that the Edison is working. The creative officer for Theranos was really just doing his job and marketing so good. Like, he was doing such a good job of, like, selling this dream that Theranos was going to change the world, but the product just didn't work. So, like, I don't know if I'm really upset with him for doing, or them, or whoever, for doing their job. It's not his job to make the product work. So let's talk about Walgreens. Enter Walgreens. If you follow this story, you know a little bit about this. So Walgreens was, like, a big player in the Theranos story. Walgreens signed a contract with Theranos. And when they signed the contract, the machine could not yet do the testing that they had promised that it could. And they were not approved for in-store testing. So this is kind of goes back to what I said about how they wanted the Edison everywhere. They wanted it in pharmacies and people's homes. So this was the first step. They were getting it into Walgreens to do testing. Walgreens never, supposedly, according to the documentary, never looked into the box or did any research of their own accord. That's not good. Big red flag right there. Theranos and Walgreens went live with testing real patients in 2013 in Arizona. You signed the contract and it wasn't ready for in-store testing, and it just seems a little hasty to me. So Theranos had a menu for testing that you could choose from as a patient. In many states, patients are not allowed to order their own blood tests without prescriptions, but Elizabeth lobbied in Arizona for laws that would allow patients to order their own lab tests. So that was something I didn't even think of. Like, you can't, like, I've gone to the doctor and been like, hey, I want to get a test for this. And they're like, well, you don't have any symptoms for that, and so we don't really think that you can do that right now. Like, it wouldn't be beneficial, so we're not going to let you do it. And I was like, all right. So I didn't really think about that in the terms of, like, just walking into a Walgreens and being like, yeah, I'll take a number 2 and a number 17 off of the blood test menu. Like, I don't know. It's weird. So Walgreens launched their wellness centers, which was, like, where the Edison was housed within, well, Walgreens. They launched these wellness centers, but there's no Edisons in store yet because, like I said, they were not ready yet. So what they would do is they would send patient samples to a lab built by Theranos in Palo Alto. So just a regular blood work lab. Like, it wasn't even the Edison lab. So technicians working in these wellness centers were inexperienced. In one particular situation, the lab director quit. Shocker. And he was replaced with a dermatologist. A phlebotomist was brought in, and they trained the Walgreens employees and pharmacists how to take blood samples because no one in Walgreens had the background or had worked with bodily fluids in the store. And when I say take blood samples, I don't mean, like, the finger pricking, because I'm pretty sure the Edison was supposed to do the finger pricking for them. They had to literally learn how to draw blood from people with, like, a vein and a syringe and a needle, like, in the arm, which was the whole reason that Theranos became a thing. Like, she didn't want that to be happening, but that's what they were doing. So these employees at Walgreens are just being trained to take blood. They don't know how to work with bodily fluids. I mean, that has its own set of rules. When I worked at a daycare, like, we had the universal health rules and stuff of, like, how to handle bodily fluids. They needed to know what to do in the case of exposure. Like, how do you handle adolescents? How do you handle children? What do you do if someone faints? It's not as simple as you think. And, like, if you have, I don't know, like, syphilis or hepatitis, and you're, like, an untrained, or if, like, a patient has that and you're an untrained Walgreens person just taking their blood, like, what if you touch it? Or, like, what if you ingest it somehow? Like, I don't know. So many doctors argued that you can't just look at the lab work. You have to look at the whole person. So with doctors, like, if a doctor orders you lab work, you can call a lab and ask questions, and, like, also, the doctor knows the patient, they know everything about them, but you couldn't really do this with Theranos. So, like, you could look at lab work and be like, oh my God, that's out of the normal range. Like, I must be not okay. But, like, maybe your doctors would look at that and be like, oh, well, you live in this environment or you have this family genetic history, so that's actually probably good. Like, your number's fine. So that's, like, a big argument that people were making. Regardless, Theranos started sending out vouchers, gift cards, whatever, to get free tests done. Like, there was these commercials where it'd be, like, an old lady and her, and then, like, her daughter and her daughter's daughter. And they'd be like, Grandma, we love you, and, like, we don't want you to die, so, like, go get this blood work. We bought you a gift card. Like, it was insane. The goal of Theranos was to be within 5 miles of every person's home. That's like Walmart. I don't even think Walmart, like, every Walmart is within 5 miles of someone's home. Unfortunately, at this point, people trusted Elizabeth because she had Walgreens on her side and investors and, like, over $400 million invested into the company. So let's talk a little bit about John Carreyrou, writer for the Wall Street Journal and author of Bad Blood. So he had just written a pretty long series on Medicare fraud before being tipped off to Theranos. And a tip came into him about Elizabeth. And a former lab employee left the company because he was becoming increasingly concerned with the practices that were occurring. This employee was terrified, though, because Theranos hired David Boies. I think I'm saying his name right. He's a really famous American lawyer. And they gave him stock in Theranos to keep employees from talking about Theranos. So David repped Al Gore, a case on behalf of the Justice Department against Microsoft, where he lit into Bill Gates for like over 20 hours of deposition. He repped Harvey Weinstein in his attempt to silence accusers. So he's like very infamous. I said he was a really famous American lawyer. He's an infamous American lawyer. He takes the cases that people don't want, and he typically does a good job with them. So for Theranos to have even hired him in the first place is like very suspicious, because I mean, if everything is going the way it should be, then like, why do you need that scary man to represent you? So this employee or former employee who reached out to John was terrified under a ton of pressure. And they still reached out to John because they were like, something needs to be done about this. And so they made John promise to keep who he was confidential. He said that Edison could only do a few of the tests that they said they could, and they were lying about the reliability and accuracy of the tests, but the company kept moving forward. Practices were not good. Best practices in labs were not being followed. So John got tested at a Walgreens. He's like, let me go see what this is about. So he goes to a Walgreens, gets tests, and they used a tourniquet and a needle. And he was like, I thought we were just doing a finger prick. Like, this is already suspicious. So, like I mentioned, the venipuncture, I don't know. Finger sticks are decreasing and venipuncture, why can't I talk? Increased. So now they're not even pricking fingers. They're just straight up taking blood from the veins. And the Theranos employees, the Walgreens employees, were given a specific thing to say to the patients. Your order requires a venipuncture draw instead. So I guess they were saying, like, with the menu of over 200 tests, they could be like, oh, well, this one needs a little bit more blood, so we're going to do venipuncture, but the more standard ones require just a finger prick. And so that was probably how they kind of got away with that. People would be like, well, okay, at least I'm getting blood work done. So they just kept opening up the Walgreens wellness centers. Like, they just kept opening them up instead of stopping to fix the Edison. They made a, quote, new version of the Edison, supposedly, but they continued to test on standard lab machines. For most tests, they used vein blood and had to buy machines to run tests like other labs. So like, they're literally buying like Quest and LabCorp type machines to run these tests. But Theranos modified these machines to work with diluted capillary samples, and they tested some of the patient's samples with the old prototype. And so diluting the capillary samples made the lab techs nervous, because that meant that they were violating the operating standards of the machines and labs, which is serious. Like, there's a reason we have these standards, and these are people's lives. So they're diluting the blood, getting inaccurate testing results, telling people these inaccurate testing results, lying about doing it in the Edison, doing it on these big lab machines. It's a whole mess. Like, I'm worked up over here. Can you tell? My next section of my notes is called Going Downhill Fast. So like I said, results are being forged. People had to run tests on devices that were not working and then forced to give patients the results. They're testing infectious diseases like hepatitis C, syphilis, prostate cancer. I don't know if prostate cancer is infectious disease, but I added that to the list. Some technicians would call patients and tell them to go to the emergency room over these results. People thought they were pregnant and then they weren't, or the other way around. It's sad. So according to the Wall Street Journal, this is a quote, one Theranos patient received results that were consistent with prostate cancer, which he later confirmed he didn't have. In another case, a woman changed the medication she was on after a false test result showed that she was no longer pregnant, but she was pregnant. Tyler Schultz, the research engineer who interned at Theranos and ended up working there, said that if, this is a quote, if 100 people with syphilis were tested with the Edison, 65 would be told that they had it and 35 would be told that they did not have it, based on the machine's operating effectiveness. So that is a fucking problem, because syphilis is insane. And I feel like I talk about syphilis a lot on this podcast for some reason. It always comes up in my stories. When monitoring for thyroid stimulating hormone, their results were not matching up with other labs, and that is another serious thing as well. They started sending people to LabCorp and seeing big discrepancies with the results. Employees went to Sunny and they said that they need to be telling people when they make mistakes or the results are wrong, but Sunny didn't care. He was like, no, we're not telling people that. Elizabeth had a ton of connections and supposedly was tight with the Obama administration. So because of this, employees were worried that she would be protected and not regulated because of her connections. Elizabeth was being very secretive about their discussions with the FDA, which would not clear or approve the Edison. Instead of filling out the necessary applications for the Edison to be approved, they would just send the FDA like weird letters. They'd put like pharmaceutical logos at the top as like supposed endorsements. Like they just were doing everything but doing the things that they should be doing. The Palo Alto lab that they built was being regulated by CMS, the federal agency in charge of regulating clinical labs. Theranos never reported the results of patient samples tested on Edison's. They would only report the results from tests ran on the third-party standard lab machines that they basically were forced to buy because the Edison didn't work. So obviously this suggests that they didn't trust the Edison test. I mean, they didn't. They just simply didn't. That's why they bought the machines. But even then, when they bought the machines, they're like diluting the samples. So it's none of it's right. Tyler Schultz decided to quit. What a king. And his grandfather at the time still believed Elizabeth and basically told Tyler to go fuck himself. He was like, you don't know what you're talking about, yada, yada, yada. So John Carreyrou and Tyler Schultz met up with each other. John sent him a LinkedIn message and Tyler bought a burner phone to talk to him. Like, that's how paranoid he was. So they met and John sent Theranos a whole list of questions based on information that Tyler gave him. But unfortunately, John slipped up and in his list of questions, he sent a specific statistic that Tyler had like individually sent to Elizabeth in an email. It was a little too specific and they were able to like say, okay, that number is very specific. Let's look through the emails. Oh, Tyler Schultz sent this to us and he recently quit. Bing, bing, bing. And they, bing, bing, bing. So they're like, okay, Tyler is talking to the media. So John meets with Elizabeth's lawyers and they told John that they know that Tyler is speaking to the Wall Street Journal and that if John publishes these articles, then he would be publishing trade secrets, which is a crime. So they gave Tyler a notice to appear in court, a temporary restraining order, and a letter from David Boies. I don't know. Tyler's parents had to pay like $400,000 to $500,000 in legal fees to protect him from Elizabeth's lawyers, and they were willing and going to sell their house to keep fighting. Luckily, that didn't have to happen. Amidst all of this going on, like things are not looking great. Somehow, on July 4th, 2015, the FDA clears the Edison, but only for one rarely used herpes test. So that was the only test that was approved that was like actually working. And this was being run on the Edison prototype. So Theranos takes this as a huge win. They have this like huge, ridiculous party that's like very uncomfortable because all the employees are like, okay, like it's one test that like no one really ever asks for. And all the other ones that really, really, really matter don't work. And all the while, Theranos is boasting revenues of more than $1 billion for 2015 when supposedly they only had a few hundred thousand dollars in revenue. So it's like, why? Why? Sometimes, like, things worth having are worth waiting for. Other employees ended up speaking to the Wall Street Journal as well, including Erica Chung. So David, the lawyer, went to Erica and said that they were going to potentially sue her. Like, they figured out that she was talking to the Wall Street Journal. Erica Chung's lawyers said that they were just trying to scare her. They're like, they can't sue you. You're not doing anything wrong. You can, however, whistleblow, and then you'll be protected. So that's what she did. And remember, in the past, I've talked about whistleblowing. Pretty much if you whistleblow, like, you're never working again. Like, nobody wants you to work for them because they think you're going to whistleblow. And you do get compensation for whistleblowing under certain circumstances. And so it's like it's a very big deal to be a whistleblower, like to be an official whistleblower. It's a big deal. And I think she was like 23 at the time. So she had just come out of college. This is like her first like big girl job. And she has to fucking whistleblow because no one else will do it. Finally, in 2015, the Wall Street Journal publishes all of this information they've received and they air all of the dirty laundry. This took eyes off Tyler, thankfully. They never took him to court or pursued any further action because they were too busy dealing with media backlash and upset investors. I thought this was like weird coincidence, synchronicity, hilarious. So Elizabeth was actually indoctrinated into the Harvard Medical School Board of Fellows the day the article was published. Like, what the fuck? Why is she being indoctrinated into that when she doesn't have any medical knowledge? So Elizabeth goes on Mad Money with Jim Cramer, and she rebuts the Wall Street Journal article, and she said all the quotes are misinformation. However, John was being asked to do tons of interviews. It was a wake-up call for Silicon Valley. There were tons of companies with valuations more than $1 billion. Startups were staying private a lot longer than older Silicon Valley companies would. Like, typically, you want to go public eventually and have people start investing in you, aside from just venture capitalists. These companies didn't have to report to investors because they were staying private. It's the perfect environment for people to commit fraud. Once all this comes out, the FDA was so worried about safety that it banned the use of the nanotainer, halting all finger testing at Walgreens. CMS did a surprise test, said the labs were so inaccurate it posed a threat to patient safety, likely to cause serious injury, harm, or even death. Like, fuck yeah, finally. These people are being told that they don't have syphilis. Like, what? I lost my place. Oh. So after this, they revoked the lab's license to operate, all because of our sweet baby, Erica. So Tyler and his grandfather, thankfully, were able to reconcile after all of this came to light. Like, apparently, when the article was first published, a lot of the board members and, like, people that worked for her were like, there's no way, this is slander, blah, blah, blah. But eventually, Tyler and his grandfather came to terms that, like, Elizabeth was all a hoax. So that's good. And I know Tyler had mentioned in the documentary he was really hoping that would happen because his father has been through a lot, like historical events that he, you know, held strong and true through, I guess. And so he was like, I would really hate for him to pass away. Also, this man is ancient. He was like, I would really hate for him to pass away and not be able to, like, clear his name. So thankfully that was the case. I guess in Laguna Beach, October 2015, shortly after the article release, Elizabeth came to a Wall Street Journal conference and was a keynote speaker. So Elizabeth had already been booked to be a part of this conference like a year before it was supposed to happen. So it's kind of funny, like, they just released this awful article about her and then she's still a keynote speaker. Which I'm like, why didn't y'all just not have her on? I don't know. But I guess they were like, this is tea. Let's see how it plays out. So she goes on there and she lies about all of the accusations on live, whatever, stream. She said that they never diluted the samples. They did not use commercially available lab equipment, blah, blah, blah. She said that they didn't have the right kind of leadership in the labs and she wasn't aware of the issues that were at hand. So she's trying to act like a victim and say that she was unaware, diverting the blame to other people. So at the beginning of this episode, I told you guys about SOX and how CEOs have to sign off saying that they are aware of everything going on. That's why you have an internal audit department. Everything that goes on in that company, that CEO is responsible for. You can't just be like, oh, I was unaware that fraud was happening, or I was unaware that this didn't work, because as a CEO, you are responsible for that. But it wasn't a public company, so I'm not really sure, like, how that goes. It's just a classic case of diverting the blame. So Elizabeth decides, after this article comes out, that she's finally going to come out and explain the machine that she kept a secret for so long. Like, for so long, she was like, no one can know this technology. Even other departments within Theranos can't know it if they're not working directly on it. And she's like, you know what? I'm just going to explain it. So she calls it the mini lab, blah, 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 blah. It's just the Edison 4.0. By 2017, Theranos had spent basically all of the over $900 million it had raised at that point. Nearly $300 million went to legal fees, to settle lawsuits from investors being like, you defrauded us, to refund all the patients in Arizona for their tests, to basically cover up this whole mess that happened after the Wall Street Journal published all of their lies. Henry Kissinger, George Shultz, and David Boies resigned at this point. In 2018, Elizabeth broke up with Sonny and fired him, and Theranos dissolved. So it basically went immediately downhill after all this came out, because patients are like, what the fuck? I was getting tested by you and you guys were lying. Like, it's a whole shit show. In 2018, this is a quote from Wikipedia, the SEC charged Theranos and Holmes with deceiving investors by, quote, massive fraud through false or exaggerated claims about the accuracy of the company's blood testing technology. Holmes settled the charges by paying a $500,000 fine. What? Like, that's not even okay. Returning 18.9 million shares to the company, relinquishing her voting control of Theranos, and being barred from serving as an officer or director of a public company for 10 years. It's kind of similar to the thing that happened with Billy. And then, okay, this is also from Wikipedia. A federal grand jury also indicted Elizabeth and Sonny on 9 counts of wire fraud and 2 counts of conspiracy to commit wire fraud for distributing blood tests with falsified results to consumers. They pled not guilty. Okay, so we're going to get into the trial, but I wanted to kind of talk about like the way people perceived her. So during her trial, Marley Spillane, a former healthcare worker who decided to attend the trial, noted that Holmes had a very straight and almost regal posture. Holmes sits stick straight in her chair all day, whether on or off the stand, her back never touching the back of her chair. First of all, I wish my posture was like that. I keep noticing myself hunched over like a little gremlin and having to sit up straight. Actually, today I like hiked my microphone up higher because I'll like notice myself doing that when I'm recording as if I'm still like in my closet, and I'm not. So Roger Parloff of Fortune magazine says she was very ingenuous when talking about stuff, but very focused and pointed when discussing her mission statement. And when I say talking about stuff, I just mean like, I guess, the specifics of the company versus like her mission statement. Like, she really cared about her mission statement. Fortune invited her to the Fortune Most Important Women's Conference, even though she was not even in charge of a Fortune 500. So make it make sense. Ken Auletta of The New Yorker says that her story is so astounding. You hear about this ultra-dedicated CEO who ate all of her meals at the office, only had water in her office, never dates, she's married to Theranos, stays at the office 24/7, and you can't help but be inspired and moved by her dedication to making the lives of patients better and longer, which I think is the theme of all of this. Everyone's like, yes, yes, like this is so good, and then she's just not executing. Dan Ariely, behavioral economist, he says that her intentions were obviously good, but the execution was bad. He said that her story should be a cautionary tale to all of us. I agree with this statement a lot because I think a lot of times when we hear stories like this, the con artist is living this like insane, lavish lifestyle or just outwardly being like an obnoxious asshole. Like, I'm thinking of Martin Shkreli or even like Billy McFarlane, Anna Sorokin. Like, this whole era of millennials scamming people is crazy. And like, yes, Elizabeth was living like lavishly to an extent. Like, she took like private planes and stuff like that. But I mean, she was doing the whole, I only wear black and I don't do anything except Theranos. So I don't know. In the case of Elizabeth, scary as she may be, she really seemed like she did care about the advancement of technology and like making patients' lives better. But I don't know if she was taking into consideration the well-being and livelihoods of her patients as much as she wanted to be known for propelling lab work into the next generation of testing. And I think that's where the lack of awareness and selfishness comes into play. So now let's talk about the trial. The trials were not televised or streamed anywhere, to my knowledge, which is super annoying. According to Rachel Lerman in an MSN article, Elizabeth faced 11 charges of criminal wire fraud. Some sources say 11 and some say 12. I'm pretty sure it's 11. But Sonny faced the same charges and they had separate trials and they've both pleaded not guilty. And I think originally it was going to be a combined trial, but then the way that Elizabeth's lawyers wanted to build their defense, they ended up having to split it into two. So supposedly, Elizabeth showed a wide spectrum of emotion while testifying, making her appear a little bit more human than normal. Like, people that knew her were like, this is so bizarre. She admitted to adding the logos of pharmaceutical companies to the tops of her reports that she gave to investors, and that she is in fact responsible for the state of the company. So here's why they have two separate trials. So Elizabeth accused Sonny of sexually assaulting and controlling her down to her daily schedule, what she ate, and how much she slept. He denies the allegations. So Elizabeth claimed that Sonny did not pressure her to say misleading things to investors, but that his abuse took a deep toll on her and, like, I guess, inspired her to do that. According to the Washington Post, Elizabeth said that he told me that I didn't know what I was doing in business. This is a quote. That my convictions were wrong, that he was astonished at my mediocrity, and that if I followed my instincts, I was going to fail, and that I needed to kill the person that I was to become what he would call a, quote, new Elizabeth who could be a successful entrepreneur. Again, that Sunny felt that I was too feminine, that I was like a little girl, and that I needed to be more like a man if I wanted to be in business. So that was a quote from Elizabeth. Some of the messages shared between Sunny and Elizabeth in 2015, I'll get into some of the details about the trial, but they pull a lot of text messages between them. And some of the things that they say are madly in love with you and your strength. And I guess Sunny was like, you are a breeze in the desert for me. Though Elizabeth's defense team is claiming that Sunny was still abusive. So I don't really have a conclusion on that. I don't think that anything came of that. Obviously, Sunny disagrees with those statements. So I don't know if there was evidence like proving that he was abusive or not. So I don't have a stance on that because I don't want to be like, he was an abusive dick when like, I don't even know. I mean, I guess that could like make sense, like why she would be acting that way. But like, I'm not concluding on any of that. It also seems like there were good times too. So who knows? Now Holmes actually has a partner named Billy Evans, and they had a baby boy on July 10th, 2021, which makes him a Cancer, yeesh. Apparently her husband like goes to Burning Man, so like right on, dude. So the Wall Street Journal they wrote so many articles. There's probably more than 50 different articles in the Wall Street Journal following the inception of Theranos. Like there's some really old articles all the way through the trials. So it's definitely worth the read if you're interested. They're really juicy. But they did like a whole trial thread where they have like articles like day by day, like following it. So I got a lot of information from that. And this next part of the notes is basically just me kind of giving you like fun facts, not fun facts, but just like bulleted notes about the trial. So on September 8th, 2021, the Wall Street Journal published that the Elizabeth Holmes trial was set to begin. The trial was expected to last for 3 months. More than 180 potential witnesses were identified, and both sides had thousands of exhibits they could enter into evidence ranging from text messages to emails to Theranos internal documentation. So Erica is our lovely whistleblower, and she was one of the first witnesses prosecutors planned to call to the stand. Elizabeth attempted to preemptively block some of the testimony from Erica, Daniel Edlin, a one-time project manager, and Denise Yam, who ran the company's financials from 2006 to 2017. Elizabeth came out swinging with attempts to challenge and object testimony against her before opening statements were even made. I think we'll talk about it, but they even like kind of silenced patients in the trial, so I really think patients got fucked over in this situation. They really didn't get any justice. It's kind of like the same situation with the Billy McFarland where like his case was just focused on him defrauding people and not the fact that he like stranded people in the middle of nowhere. And so they had to do like a class action lawsuit. I didn't see anything about that for the patients that were tested with Theranos, but hopefully, I don't know. So Theranos formally dissolved in 2018, as I mentioned before, after the company had settled with their investors, lab regulators, and the SEC. This is a quote, Silicon Valley startups are often perceived to be walking a thin line between exaggeration and deception in promoting their products. Between March 2015 and February 2016, Theranos spent $28.6 million, with the largest single recipient being Boies Schiller Flexner LLP, so David, their lawyers. So basically, they spent $28.6 million in lawyer fees for everything that happened, as well as more than 17 other vendors for marketing, media, and PR, patent and legal work, lobbying, and recruiting. So not working on the machine, doing everything but working on the machine. According to Robert Leach, an assistant U.S. attorney, Elizabeth had serious money problems starting in 2009, so way early on, where they struggled to make payroll. Denise Spivey said that they had to take out a loan to make payroll, personally backed by Sunny. By 2013, they were blowing through $1 to $2 million a week. Denise Spivey said the company went years without having their financial statements audited, which she would have expected investors would want to see to add to the credibility of Theranos. Yes. Man, rich people just like, they weren't thinking with their brains. According to Spivey, the company had net losses of $11.5 million in 2009, $16.2 million in 2010 and $27.5 million in 2011. So just loss after loss after loss, large losses. Leach said that Theranos had contracts with AstraZeneca, Novartis, Merck, Pfizer, the Mayo Clinic, and the American Burn Association. Apparently, Pfizer concluded after a $900,000 deal with Theranos that they had, quote, no use for Theranos' technology. Holmes, however, gave reports to Walgreens and investors that Pfizer endorsed the Edison. So, lying. There were no revenue-generating contracts found with the Defense Department disproving the claims that they had worked with the military. And from 2003 to 2015, Theranos had accumulated losses of $585 million, though there was a list of projections shown to investors estimating $140 million in revenue in 2014 and $990 million in revenue in 2015. The letter that Chung wrote to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services was 1,800 words long and alleged that Theranos ignored staff credentials, obviously, ignored all of the experienced employees, including Ian Gibbons. My fucking heart breaks for him. They frequently used expired lab supplies, and she claimed that the Edisons had major stability, precision, and accuracy problems, all of which were substantiated. Apparently, Theranos paid more than $150,000 to an investigations firm in an attempt to silence Ms. Chung and Mr. Schultz. One night after work, a man approached Chung and gave her a letter with a temporary address she had been staying at on it and basically threatened her with legal action if she continued to speak to the Wall Street Journal. Well, you know what she said? Fuck you, I'm whistleblowing. Of Ian Gibbons, Rochelle Gibbons, his widow, spoke to the Wall Street Journal about her husband's suicide following issues that occurred while working at Theranos. Theranos sent a letter to Rochelle claiming that she would be sued if she continued to make, quote, false statements about Elizabeth. Sonny and Elizabeth were talking shit, basically, about their partnership with Walgreens and spent time focusing on other deals that they wanted to be making with companies like Safeway and CVS. Like, maybe get your shit together first. They were also not making good on major milestones that they had agreed upon in their contract with Walgreens. All the while, they're, like, boasting this partnership to investors as a means to show progress Theranos was making. So they're just using Walgreens to be like, look at this contract we have. It fucking sucks. We're not doing anything right, but look at it. Walgreens dissolved the partnership in 2016 when they learned that Theranos was, quote, voiding or correcting tens of thousands of lab reports. They sued Theranos for $140 million and only got half of that. Apparently, they had actually made progress with Safeway, too, in a contract, but continued to miss big deadlines, even after Safeway had already built out clinics in its stores for the Edisons. Chung claims that quality control tests continually failed, indicating the machines were not safe to use on patient samples. The lab associates were expected to manipulate data in order to keep the company operating. Yes, we know this. So what was supposed to take 2 hours to get the test results took about 2 to 3 days. Patients were given misleading documents for requesting lab work, and only 4 to 9 tests could actually be ran on the Edison with a finger prick, and the rest of the over 200 offerings needed to be ran with a venous draw, even on standardized machines. Theranos tests were often, this is a quote, also all of this is from the Wall Street Journal threads. So, quote, Theranos tests were often cheaper than standard laboratory tests, and the company charged uninsured patients the same as insured patients, according to court testimony. So, like, that's cool. I'm cool with that. But it doesn't really matter if the test results are not accurate. A text message from Sonny was shown in court discussing a team who stayed up working till 3 a.m. one night and then returned to work the next day at 10 a.m. as an example of what the other teams at the company should be doing. So this just shows you the level of pressure that these teams were under. Elizabeth's lawyers made an agreement with the judge that the patients called as witnesses to discuss their results from being tested by Theranos could not discuss the emotional impacts of receiving incorrect test results, particularly one patient who was pregnant, but was told by Theranos that she was miscarrying. So fucked up beyond so much. I mean, I guess I understand why they want to keep it separate because this trial was about, like, financial stuff. So maybe they should have, like, another trial about, like, the emotional impacts where the patients get what they deserve. But, like, I don't give a shit. Like, that is traumatic. Let her talk about her experience. So PwC, which is an accounting firm, PricewaterhouseCoopers, was in charge of compiling nearly 81,000 of Elizabeth's text messages, and it took more than 10,000 hours and 40 employees to do the task. Sonny said in a text to Elizabeth, quote, We built software to remove human error and human judgment. All day, I saw these people use their judgments to work around our processes. Like, yeah, because the engineers and scientists are literally telling you that what you want is not possible, so obviously they're going against the software. Like, your software is not working. Make the software work, and then they won't need to use their judgment. Elizabeth paid her board members $150,000 a year. Jim Mattis invested $85,000 of his own money into Theranos. So I think I mentioned earlier that, like, after the Wall Street Journal made its first publications, the board members publicly supported Elizabeth, but, like, privately were like, what the fuck is going on? And then eventually they all basically turned on her. The FDA said that the company's lab was improperly using the nanotainer to ship blood samples without FDA approval. Lab director Adam Rosendorf tried to convince Elizabeth that the Edisons were not ready for launch on real patients because they were getting inaccurate results on simple tests for things like glucose, but they moved forward anyway. Rosendorf forwarded emails from Theranos to his personal Gmail account to keep record, badass, and he refused to send half-ass explanations to questions that doctors asked about their inaccurate test results. He then asked Elizabeth and Sunny to remove him from the lab license so that he wouldn't be held responsible for the issues at the lab, and that's when Sunny decided that they were going to, like, fire him, but he was like, I'm quitting before you can do that. Holmes's lawyer claimed during, this is a quote, during the period of the charged conspiracy and throughout Mrs. Holmes and Mr. Balwani's relationship, she deferred to and relied on what she perceived to be Mr. Balwani's business acumen. She relied on Mr. Balwani to provide her with accurate information about the state of the company's operations. Paige Williams, a former personal assistant for Elizabeth, claims that she joined just before the Wall Street Journal article dropped and after they quickly cut their luxurious travel. So, like, chartered planes, no more raises were planned. She also said that she would go shopping for Elizabeth at Neiman Marcus and, like, ordered flowers for Sunny for Valentine's Day on her behalf. Like, ew. One patient was on blood-thinning medication and was using Theranos tests to update their dosing, and their doctor raised their dose, which made them no longer feel, quote, right, and they started having noticeable bruising because, like, they didn't need to be upping the dose because the test results were wrong. The argument that Elizabeth's lawyers are making is that she wasn't defrauding anyone because she genuinely thought the machines worked and she thought what she was telling investors and the public was genuinely true. The fraud comes from the lab directors not doing their jobs as lab directors, which, like, that's obviously not the case. Finally, there are email threads between Holmes and employees about how to take the lab inspectors down different paths within their facility so that they could keep certain areas hidden. So there is a lot that was covered in these Wall Street Journal articles, and I took a lot from that. Definitely go check it out. It's definitely worth the read if you're interested in this kind of thing. I just don't want to, like, keep taking from the articles over and over again, but there's a lot to look at. Sunny's trial was postponed for a while because COVID was getting bad, or, like, we kind of had that flare up this year in, like, March, I think, or February. So, like, he got pushed back. But according to the New York Times, Elizabeth was found guilty of 4 counts of fraud. Ms. Holmes was found not guilty on 4 other counts related to defrauding patients who had used Theranos' blood tests, which I'm like, literally, what the fuck? Each count carries a maximum sentence of 20 years in prison, terms that are likely to be served concurrently. Elizabeth Holmes, 37, is expected to appeal. So I'm not sure what her exact sentencing was like, but that's what they said. And then, according to NBC, Balwani was found guilty on all 12 felony counts of defrauding both Theranos investors and the patients who relied on wildly unreliable blood tests that could have jeopardized their health. So I thought it was very interesting that Balwani was found guilty on all counts and Elizabeth wasn't. So it does make me curious. Like, this episode is already super long, so I'm not going to go into tons of detail about Sonny's court case, but I guess with him being the chief operating officer, like, I don't know. He seems very spicy. Like, he seems like a very, like, mad person. So I'm curious what they, like, found. Like, I'm sure there was emails of him being like, I don't care, like, move forward. I mean, based on what the employees were saying. But yeah, so that's that. And then the patients have basically just been left in the dark. Like, the patients didn't really get any sort of, like, help. I mean, I think they were, like, refunded for their tests, but, like, that's about it. So it's pretty fucked up. I don't really have, like, a conclusion on how I feel about it because I think I did a really good job of expressing the way that I feel about it, like, throughout the case. So I'm just going to leave it at that. I've been wanting to do that case forever, and I feel very accomplished that I finally did it. So I'm going to wrap it up. I love you guys. Please follow us at ProfSkep Podcast. That's at ProfSkep Podcast on Instagram and Twitter. You can email me at professionalskepticismpodcast@gmail.com. Sign up to be a Patreon. There's 4 different tiers ranging from $3 to $15. And you can do that at patreon.com/ProfSkepPodcast. And I think that's it for right now. I love you guys. Stay sus skeptics. I will see you next week. Mwah!